Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
I don't think there's any reason to think that the vote has dropped in that time, and I suspect that with Corey Bernardi and the attention on Pauline Hanson over the last few days, support is likely to have gone up.
One Nation announces a lead candidate for South Australia.
Really concerned that that tragedy would spread to become a tragedy for the dingoes as well, and it did.
Queensland dingo cull sparks concerns from activists. And later today...
I was hoping you were going to ask me that. I think someone who's experienced Independence Day and independence of a nation will see it quite differently. I don't think we know enough.
Man charged after explosive device allegedly thrown at Invasion Day rally. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The South Australian election campaign is underway, with former federal Liberal Senator Corey Bernardi announced as One Nation's lead candidate. Bernardi has criticised Labor and the Liberals, claiming there is no effective opposition. With just over 6 weeks until the vote, the Greens warn One Nation could hold the balance of power in upper house. Radio Adelaide's Emma Watsky spoke with Robert Sims, Greens MLC, and Clem McIntyre, Professor of Politics at the University of Adelaide, for more.
Look, I am concerned about Corey Bernardi returning to South Australian politics. I mean, this guy's got more baggage than a 747, and he's got a history of making really controversial and offensive views. He's made comments in his book, The Conservative Revolution, where he talks about same-sex families and single-parent families being less than optimum. And he's also expressed some pretty radical views around industrial relations, like the idea that small businesses should be able to just hire and fire without undue influence from government. And he's even criticised free school breakfast programs.
And One Nation more broadly have proposed policies that say they'll improve the lives of everyday Australians, such as tax-free room rental, stamp duty reform, just to name a couple. But they also claim that migration is a major driver of the housing crisis. How do you respond to this?
Well, South Australia is absolutely in the midst of a housing crisis. Indeed, it's the worst housing crisis we've seen in generations. And I know lots and lots of South Australians are struggling. But the cause of the housing crisis is not migration. It's the decisions that have been made by politicians over the years, the failure to invest in public housing infrastructure, the fact that we've allowed housing to be treated as a commodity in Australia and therefore given landlords the opportunity to hike up rents without any controls. And let's not forget we have the most generous negative gearing scheme in the world that encourages housing to be treated as an investment class. So it's those decisions that are driving the housing crisis.
And the party say it will run candidates in all seats. Would this impact, I guess, the Greens or your positioning?
Look, the Greens are going to be running candidates in every seat as well. So I'm feeling very optimistic and excited about our election campaign. We've got a huge amount of energy on the ground, and I think we've got a real opportunity to win two members of the Legislative Council for the first time.
Under the current upper house system in South Australia, 8% of votes are needed by One Nation for a candidate to be elected. Clem McIntyre, Emeritus Professor of Politics at Adelaide University, says it's likely that Corey Bernardi will receive those.
Well, I think it's likely that One Nation will get at least 8% of the vote. The polls late last year, before Corey Bernardi's name was mentioned, had them at about, I think, 11 or 12%. And I don't think there's any reason to think that the vote has dropped in that time. And I suspect that with Corey Bernardi and the attention on Pauline Hanson over the last few days, support is likely to have gone up a bit. So I think there's every chance that Corey Bernardi will be elected to the South Australian upper house.
And there is some concern that this might overpower the opposition. opposition. What are your, what's your response there?
I think that One Nation is very unlikely to win a seat in the lower house where government is formed, in the House of Assembly. While they'll have a presence in the upper house, and they did do for a number of years after the 2022 election, I don't think that's going to constitute a transformative moment in South Australian politics. I think the Liberal Party are going to struggle at this election. The likelihood is that Labor will win more seats and that the Liberals will lose some of their metropolitan seats. But the fact that One Nation win a seat in the upper house is significant.
That was Robert Sims, Greens MLC, and Clem McIntyre, Professor of Politics at the University of Adelaide, speaking with Radio Adelaide's Emma Watsky. The Queensland government announced it has culled six dingoes in Gari after the death of Piper James. The announcement has brought concerns to conservation groups and First Nations communities. A new petition created by the Dingo Conservancy asked the state government to stop culling dingoes and instead to work in non-invasive strategies to protect the species. 4EB's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Dr. Joe Samuel King, co-founder and secretary of the Dingo Conservancy, for more.
We were horrified. Firstly, our hearts went out to Piper James and her family, and we could tell right from the beginning that it was a tragedy for her family. We were also really concerned that that tragedy would spread to become a tragedy for the dingoes as well, and it did. We saw right early on that drowning was, you know, when the coroner came out and said that death was consistent with drowning, that made sense. Still, we thought dingoes may be involved. We don't know. But the reality is dingoes are dangerous, just like water is dangerous. But when someone drowns, we don't attempt to kill the ocean. We manage ourselves around it. So similarly, dingoes are a force of nature. They can be dangerous. We need to manage ourselves, not kill dingoes when they do what they naturally do.
So why are dingoes so critical to the environment, and why is there a stigma around dingoes?
So dingoes are what are called a keystone species. As an apex predator, they are absolutely crucial for keeping Australian ecosystems in balance. They do that two main ways. They put pressure, downward pressure, on grazing animals, everything from kangaroos to rabbits to feral pigs, deer. And they also put downward pressure and keep animals such as foxes and cats on their toes, so much so that they're crucial for small endangered mammals and birds, persistence and survival. Dingoes are the heartbeat of country. That's from a song known as Don't Shoot the Dingo by Gilbury Creations. It was created in response to the killing of the dingoes on Kigari and is a fantastic pro-dingo conservation song. They belong in country and they heal country. This is a concept being developed by traditional owner woman Kellyanne Blake, who is taking the Victorian government to court. I think your other question is, why are they so controversial and why have they been so persecuted? That's a very big question, and I think it comes back to the colonial mentality, the way that white man has of seeing land. When settlers first arrived, we saw a land that we didn't understand.
So what is the Dingo Conservancy doing to raise awareness about dingoes and their importance in our communities?
We've started with a Facebook group that is growing by the day to around 7,000 currently. So if anyone's interested, it's the Dingo Conservancy. We're also going to be holding a series of webinars over the next year. The first is on the 15th of February, and the link will be through our Facebook group. We will also be doing some capacity building for dingo advocates, training dingo advocates up so that they feel confident to do a presentation to politicians, to community groups, to school groups, and we'll be providing them with information packs. We're also working towards a nationwide petition.
I understand you've launched this petition on change.org, asking the Queensland government particularly to stop calling the dingoes. Could you please explain a little bit more about that? And it already had around 13,000 signatures.
Yes, this was a simple petition. We have a very small population of dingoes, somewhere between 70 to 200 on Kogari. They're genetically very vulnerable, they are ecologically and culturally very precious, and we've got to find other ways of managing people on that island.
That was Dr. Jo Samuel King, co-founder and secretary of the Dingo Conservancy, speaking with 4EB's Eduardo Jordan. In Western Australia, a 31-year-old man is in custody after being charged with intent to cause harm and possessing explosives after a device was allegedly thrown into the middle of an Invasion Day rally. As First Nations people continue to call for the date to be changed, some on the political right appeared divided in their response this year. National Radio News political reporter Noah Sacombe spoke with Kaz Roz, independent political commentator, and pastor Peter Makwe for more.
Man was never created to be locked up and controlled and manipulated by a superpower. Man was, in our different cultural settings, we were supposed to be free in there. Receiving that was a tremendous joy.
Do you feel a deeper level of understanding as someone from similarly British colonized nation, but without the explicit freedom of an Independence Day or an independent state? What are your reflections on the Australian population? Do you feel any deeper understanding that perhaps a lot of us are missing?
I was hoping you were going to ask me that. I think someone who's experienced Independence Day and independence of a nation will see it quite differently. I don't think we know enough about the First Nation people. I don't think we are tolerant enough. It saddens me. I've had the opportunity of meeting, they've done well in life, right? And they're Aborigines. And they still believe that part of the issue is not just what the invaders did. There's a part of the issue is them. So that's really calling for not a blame game. That's calling for a partnership, that's calling for unity. Let's get together and work this out.
So as a black man yourself, do you think that part of your identity feeds into your sense of injustice on behalf of First Nations people here?
That's a very emotive question. There's a massive elephant in the room and we're not picking it up. As a black man, to see fellow black men, black people, under the heavy hand of either a political system or a system in which we live. When I grew up in England, I grew up with a mentality that I don't believe in color because I had to work twice as hard to be considered equal. But I didn't let that affect me. The black thing can work for you or can work against you. We've got to make sure that we eliminate that racist element within our culture and how we live, to drink water from the land, to mine the things that God's put underneath their ground. If they mine it, then the multinationals, large corporates will take 99% of the profit and leave them with nothing. I'm not exaggerating. In some cases, they get nothing. So as a black person living out of England, it was tough. But coming to Australia, I think it's a lot easier going here. But it's still, still within community you can pick up elements of racism, but we have to learn to live above it, believe for a better future where, according to Martin Luther King, all our dream becomes reality and we're all free.
I think something that a lot of white Australians struggle with is perhaps a sense of place, because we don't have a land that we can comfortably call ours, and that we like there's such a disconnect between where we live and where our ancestors come from. How does it feel to have that sense of place, that sense of belonging and of a nation?
This is the best question out of all the conversation. There is something about the Igbo man. I was born in Lagos, Nigeria. I grew up in the UK. I'm now living in Australia. But one thing you cannot take away from an Igbo man is his land. And I still can go to where my father has his home. And that becomes the property of the first son. And that's why a lot of Nigerians who live abroad, once they've made it, they go back to Nigeria and they build a mansion. But they build things that are humongous. Nobody's ever going to live there. But at the end of the day, we love the connection to our land. So independence means a lot more to, I guess, to that culture and to me that it might mean to an Aussie, because it's the oppressor is gone. I can go back to my roots. My land is mine. I'm free. There's still a home that you've got. There's the heritage of what my father did and what his father did.
That was National Radio News political reporter Noah Sukome with the story. Iran is facing one of the biggest challenges since the Islamic Republic was established in 1979, with mass protests erupting across the country over rising living costs, corruption, and women's rights. The unrest has been met with violent government crackdown, leaving thousands of protesters dead and many more imprisoned. To SER, Stephen Hill spoke with Professor Amin Sakal from the Australian National University about whether the Iranian regime can withstand the scale of public discontent.
I think, as you pointed out, there are different accounts of the number of the people who've been killed. Some have said that 6,000, and some other people have said something like 30,000. So one can never really be sure exactly how many people were killed, but obviously also thousands were injured, and there has been also mass arrests. I mean, the protests started for economic reasons, because the Iranian currency had collapsed and the economy had extremely been weakened. And the shopkeepers and the business people came out to protest. Since the grievances of many other people in the country led to expansion of those protests and dominated most of the major cities and even some of the smaller towns. But the government looks like has succeeded in putting down the uprisings, and the security forces have once again prevailed, but of course at a very high human cost and also at the severe criticism of the government's handling of the situation.
So what do you see as the short-term and medium future of Iran? According to Karim Sajapour of the Carnegie Endowments of Peace, he describes Iran as a zombie regime in which very few people believe in the ideology of the government. However, at the same time, the government can still count on the fierce loyalty of the Iran Revolutionary Guard and the Basi paramilitary force. How do you see it playing out?
Well, I think that's true. So far, the instruments of state power, that is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the paramilitary Basij, the revolutionary committees, the religious circles, the networks of the mosques, the armed forces have remained loyal to the regime, and there has not been reports of major defection from these forces to the opposition side. As long as that remains the case, the regime has relatively strong support in the countryside, then one cannot expect the fall of the regime anytime soon. But of course, the regime is also under pressure from outside, that is particularly from the United States and Israel, which would like to really see the back of the regime. Again, one has to be very careful, because the United States is not really going to be able to bring about a regime change in Iran by operations from the air or from the sea. In the past, whenever the United States has tried to bring about regime change, it has basically invaded that country. Of course, one of the major concerns of the Gulf is that Iran may try to close the Strait of Hormuz. And of course, it is through the Strait of Hormuz that something like 20-25% of the world oil goes through. that could cause a serious energy crisis, you know, around the world.
So while the US and Iran have been at loggerheads for almost 45 years, there have been brief moments when there have been possibilities of rapprochement. During the late 90s and the early 2000s, when Iran was actually providing some assistance to the US in Afghanistan, and more recently with the Iran nuclear deal negotiated by Barack Obama and John Kerry, is there any chance that the US and Iran could possibly find a way to negotiate?
President Pezeshkian has said that they are willing to negotiate with the United States, and as I understand that there's some indirect talks going on between the two sides. But the American demand are very high. They want Iran to forego any uranium enrichment, and also it wants Iran to dismantle or dramatically reduce its missile production or sever its ties with some of its affiliates, or what the Americans call proxies in the region. There is a possibility of a negotiated settlement when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. I think their latest report suggested that the Iranians may be prepared to suspend their nuclear program, and they've always said it's only for peaceful purposes, perhaps on the basis of the July 2015 nuclear agreement.
That was Professor Amin Sakhal from the Australian National University speaking to 2SER's Stephen Hill. New research suggests periods remain a major and often overlooked barrier to playing sports in Australia. A 2024 survey by Share the Dignity found nearly 7 in 10 athletes have skipped games because of their period. With the Brisbane 2032 Olympics on the horizon, advocates say it's time for supporting clubs and codes to tackle menstruation inequality and make participation more inclusive. For Triple Z's Mary Kate Hannigan spoke with Rochelle Courtney, founder and managing director of Share the Dignity, for more.
Bloody Good Sport is there to ensure that nobody misses out on sport because of their period. And I think until we address the lack of education on menstruation to men and to women, we will never have an equal playing field. With 68% of menstruators having skipped sport, 90% is a fear of leaking. Now, if period products are just in a training bag, that eliminates that. We'll still have a fear, but I will tell you, I used to play netball, played netball for 40 years of my life. I had suffered severely with endometriosis. So for me to play, I needed to have a pad and a tampon in, and I needed to change, go to the bathroom before I played, and I had to run off at halftime. Now, I always had a tampon in both sides of my bra so that I knew that if I needed to, I went. Now, we're trying to eliminate that. I never told a coach. I never told anybody. It was so embarrassing. How can we do better now that we know better?
Do you think that this anxiety, do you think it's from the social stigma or from physical symptoms?
I think it's a social stigma. I think that if we're not going to training as 13-year-old girls and a coach is openly talking about, or even having the information about the strength and power you have at different cycles, points in your cycle, that makes it open conversation. That takes away the shame and stigma. Over the years, it will be completely gone. And so then when you do have your period, and those who are 1 in 8 who suffer with endometriosis can openly say, you know what, I'm having a really bad period today. I might just sit out of this bit. But without that open conversation, that's never going to take place.
The root of the issue is access, is it education or culture within Australian sport, you know, knowing that these organisations are historically very male dominated?
I think it is a mix of all. I know that I worked with the NRL on bringing about the education page that we have called A Coach in the Know. So if there is a 30% increase in girls participating in rugby league, how can they retain those girls? And how can they make sure that Ruby's dad, who Ruby's 14 and her dad has put his hand up to coach, what does he need to know about the team when it comes to menstruation? Because I can bet you Ruby's mum and dad were not adequately educated on menstruation. For men, I can't even imagine what that number is, but for women, 52% of women felt like they were not adequately educated on menstruation. I can't even imagine what that number is for men.
And from what you've seen so far, are sporting organisations stepping up?
Yeah, I think they want to.
But it's not just sporting organisations. For example, I spoke to Soccer Australia and they're like, we're all on board. We've changed our uniforms so that the girls don't have to wear white shorts. We, you know, Tennis Australia talking about doing the same thing. But when the girls are playing at a council bathroom, When the girls are then playing or training at a council facility, those council facilities don't have a sanitary bin. They certainly don't have access to free period products. And so it's going to take all of us to play a role in ensuring that there is menstrual equity in Australia.
Looking forward to the Brisbane Olympics in 2032, what would success or a big progress in terms of menstrual equity look like by the time the Olympics arrive?
Yeah, by 2030, Share the Dignity is calling on menstrual equity. So it means that no matter where you are, whether you're getting an education, you're playing sport, or you're at work, or you're out in public, you should be able to get access to free period products. You should also, there should also be a sanitary bin in every bathroom that you're visiting. It is not okay for girls to be playing sport and having to put their tampon back into a bag to take home to get rid of it. We want every stadium fitted with free period products and sanitary bins.
That was Rochelle Courtney, founder and managing director of Share the Dignity, speaking to 4ZZZ's Mary Kate Hannigan. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.